This free State of Belief radio podcast is brought to you by Interfaith Alliance, representing 185,000 members across the U.S., drawn from 75 different faith traditions. We're committed to protecting faith and freedom. Find out about the work we do to protect the boundaries between religion and government and unite diverse voices to challenge extremism and build common ground by visiting our website, interfaithalliance.org. Whether you care deeply about minority religious rights, school bullying, LGBT discrimination, the influence of religion on politics, or the influence of politics on religion, Interfaith Alliance is working on initiatives you'll want to support. Learn more and become a member at interfaithalliance.org. From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the beautifully redecorated Argo Studios in New York City. We're in New York City this weekend for the annual Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Award Gala. You may recall from earlier shows where this year we're honoring Jim Lehrer, the noted broadcaster on PBS, and we're also honoring a person you've heard on this show a lot of times, Reverend Dr. Jane Holmes Dixon, who was the second woman ever ordained as a bishop in the Anglican Church in America. It's indisputable that personal faith, organized religion, and values issues greatly influence the politics and governing of our nation. That's why it is so important to track where Americans stand in this regard. An invaluable resource to do just that is the Public Religion Research Institute's annual American Values Survey, just released for 2011 and packed full of insights that will be of interest to political strategists and engaged citizens alike. We're going to look at the highlights of this year's survey with PRRI's CEO and founder, Dr. Robert P. Jones, no stranger to State of Belief radio listeners.
We stay. Why? If God doesn't give a rat's ass about the vulture and what he does for a living, what he's done to Africa, why should I?
Born in L.A., living in New York, famous on British television, best-selling investigative journalist Greg Palast's new book, Vulture's Picnic, comes out this week. He'll be here in the studio to talk about his investigations of what can only be called global evil that fill the pages of this book, and about how he has managed to retain a sense of faith and purpose in the face of that evil. But first,
when you get beat, you have to admit it, and you got to congratulate and shake the hands of those folks who prevailed.
That's Ohio's Republican Governor John Kasich responding to voters rejecting SB 5 this past week. More and more, as legislative gridlock continues to consume Washington, D.C., important government decisions with national implications are happening at the state level. One reason is the concerted effort of national groups to involve themselves at the state level, such as the National Organization for Marriage, an anti-equality group, or the Notorious Family Research Council. Groups like the Chamber of Commerce write legislative templates that we see appear in state legislatures as bills. All of this makes elections at the state level more significant than ever in determining the direction of our nation. And on the line with me right now is Kevin Ekstrom, Editor-in-Chief of Religion News Service, for a look at what last Tuesday's voting results may tell us about where things are and where they're going as we look towards the 2012 presidential election. Kevin, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks for having me.
2010 was a bad year for progressives at the ballot box. This year, we saw possibly strong support for labor, as in Ohio, for reducing obstacles to voting in Maine, for some reproductive rights in Mississippi. Is that reading too much into state-specific voting patterns?
I think what it says is, more than anything, that the more things change, the more things change. We're in a very fluid environment right now. There's a lot of turbulence out there, political turbulence. There's a lot of people who are upset, who are angry. And, you know, in 2010, they took that out on the Democrats. To some extent, in 2011, they took that out on some of the Republicans. You know, you can read too much, you can read too little into it, but I think what it really says is that the conservative dominance narrative that we had coming out of 2010 may have been a little short-sighted, and there may be more going on here than just Republicans taking control of the country.
There are a whole lot of major state initiatives, especially conservative-backed initiatives, that are seen these days as test cases that are intended to spread to other states if they succeed in one state. Do you think there's a chance the opposite might prove true this time? Labor, women's health, voting rights issues are in play in a whole lot of places, not just in a few?
Sure, absolutely. And I think, you know, Wisconsin sort of led the charge on the union front with the union busting bill that Governor Walker passed. And, you know, they had their own sort of ramifications on that on some recall elections. They tried to do it in Ohio and obviously lost at the ballot box. So I think what it says is that the thing that seems to work in one place isn't necessarily going to work in other places. There's a lot of things in flux and a lot of things in play. So I think anyone who makes a gamble on this is what's going to happen, whatever that may be, is only going to be proved wrong, because I think things are too up in the air and too volatile right now.
Well, let's go south. Mississippi's Initiative 26, intended to amend the state constitution to define life as beginning at fertilization, was driven to a great degree by ultra-conservative religious rhetoric. Religion continues to be a powerful motivator for lawmaking, especially in conservative states. I don't guess that's going to change soon, is it?
No, and I'm going to step back just a little bit on what I just said about precedents and say that I think Mississippi might actually be different in that if this amendment could not pass in Mississippi, I have strong doubts that it could be passed anywhere else. They've already failed twice in Colorado, which would be much more of a purple state, much more of kind of a mainstream state that looks a lot closer to the rest of the country. Mississippi was intended to be the sure bet that they could get this passed because it's evangelical, it's conservative, it's Republican. But what happened was it was not a good piece of legislation. I mean, it was so vague that everyone got scared off by what could happen or the unintended consequences. You know, the Personhood USA movement that's behind it says, oh, well, we're going to go to other states, and they're going to go to places like California. Well, I doubt they're going to have any success there. I mean, they're certainly never going to get this kind of thing passed in a New York or a Massachusetts or even, I would say, in Ohio. So I'm not going to say that this movement is dead, but I think Tuesday's vote showed the really, really steep uphill climb that they have in convincing people about this if they couldn't even convince Mississippi.
There's some folks, Kevin, who say that last Tuesday's vote was a response to Republican overreach. In fact, some reporters have called it a pendulum swing. What's your work at Religion News Service suggest on that?
It's a similar dynamic from what we saw after 2008, where you know, people accused President Obama and the Democrats of overreach. What people seem to be saying is they want kind of common sense solutions. They want things that actually are going to address the problems. But when it comes to pocketbook issues, the other thing that you're seeing with the Wall Street, you know, Occupy Wall Street movement and the corporate protests is that people want it done fairly. And if there's going to be pain and sacrifice, they want everyone to share that. So that's what I think you saw in Ohio. They know that we have to make tough decisions. They know that things are bad, but they don't want to do it on the backs of, in Ohio, on the backs of policemen and firefighters and school teachers. What people seem to be crying for is, you know, common sense solutions that don't pit one side against another, that are done in a fair way and where the sacrifice, you know, is shared as much by the 1% as it is by the 99%.
Kevin Ekstrom is editor-in-chief of Religion News Service, which accurately bills itself as the only secular news service devoted to unbiased coverage of religion and ethics, exclusively. The website is www.religionnews.com. I'm grateful to you for being with us again today on State of Belief Radio.
Happy to do it.
We have to take a quick break, but we'll be right back with PRRI's CEO and founder, Dr. Robert P. Jones. I'm Welton Getty. You're listening to State of Belief Radio. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio, everyone. I'm Welton Getty. Among the many important surveys and reports issued every year by the Public Religion Research Institute, the yearly American Values Survey is particularly rich in valuable insights and always offers some eye-opening conclusions. Here to give us a quick tour through this year's American Values Survey is PRRI's CEO and founder, Dr. Robert P. Jones. Robbie, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Hi, thanks, Welton. I'm really happy to be here.
The American Values Survey is a substantial work, and for listeners who may not be familiar with it, I wonder if you'd just start by explaining what the objectives of this survey are.
So the American Values Survey that Public Religion Research Institute conducts every year is really our flagship survey that is designed to get at what are some of the most pressing issues at the intersection of religion, values, and public life, particularly as it obtains to the election cycle. So for this year, we really focused in on three things. One is around the controversy surrounding Mitt Romney and his Mormon faith and how reactions to that may or may not impact his candidacy. Two, evaluations of the Obama presidency as we're kind of poised to enter the 2012 campaign season. And three, what are American values around the economy and economic justice and inequality? These values and issues that have really been raised very strongly of late by the Occupy Wall Street movement.
Okay, so against that backdrop, Robbie, what did you find most noteworthy in this year's survey? In other words, what made it into the press release?
Yeah, well, let me start with Mitt Romney and his Mormon faith and how it's going to impact his candidacy. Two-thirds of Americans say that it's very important for presidential candidates to have strong religious beliefs. Yet when we did some sort of dug deeper under that number this time and found out that 19% of the public, that is one in five, says, but that's only true if those religious beliefs are similar to their own. That is, if they're different from their own, they'd actually be less likely to vote for that candidate. And that actually figures fairly large in Romney's candidacy. I guess the money number here is that about 4 in 10 voters expressed discomfort with the idea of a Mormon president in the country. And this is particularly acute among white evangelical Protestant Christians, which are such a critical voting bloc in the Republican primary process. That number goes up to 47% of white evangelical Protestant voters.
You know, one chart caught my eye in particular. 80% of Republicans were uncomfortable with the idea of an atheist president. 81% of Republicans were uncomfortable with a Muslim president. The percentages for Democrats are 70% and 56%, respectively.
Right. The Constitution guarantees that there should be no religious tests for office in this country. However, what the numbers show is that Americans, you know, really do continue to think about, you know, religious identity as a important characteristic in a president and in a presidential candidate. Now, I should say this doesn't necessarily mean they wouldn't vote for the candidate at the end of the day. That's not the question here. But it does mean that they, you know, just going into it, and asking about a candidate in general, this is an attribute that they have some misgivings about.
Robbie, that's pretty consistent with what we've seen in prior years. Is there any area in this year's survey where you saw particularly noteworthy change?
Yeah. One place I want to point to here is the millennial generation. They're not going to play an outsized role in the primary process, but once we get to the general election, you know, if Mitt Romney is the candidate, one of the things that we see is that the millennial generation is much more accepting, you know, of Muslims, of atheists, of other kind of religious minorities in the country. They have much less misgivings than the rest of the country. But curiously enough, they have more misgivings about a Mormon president than the rest of the country and than seniors do.
Robbie, are there any broad themes that emerge when you look at the survey results overall?
Yeah, that's a great question. One of the things we were surprised to see in the survey was actually some points of consensus. We're in a very polarized political environment. It's, you know, about to get probably more polarized as we head into this election season. But there are some places where, especially on the issues of economic inequality and on policies to address the gap between the rich and the poor, where there are actually some surprising points of consensus. On a couple of these policy issues, we actually do see, you know, 7 in 10 Americans overall, so for example, say that we should raise the tax rate for those making $1 million or more a year, 7 in 10 Americans. And what that means is that across the board, majorities of every religious group agrees with this policy, and even majorities of Republicans agree with this policy. The only group that really stands on the other side is Americans who consider themselves part of the Tea Party movement, where less than a majority agrees. And the other policy we asked about was increasing the minimum wage from $7.25 to $10 an hour. Two-thirds of Americans, again, including majorities of Democrats, Independents, and Republicans, and majorities of every major religious group, excuse me, support raising the minimum wage. And again, the only group standing on the other side where less than a majority supports raising the minimum wage is the Americans who identify with the Tea Party. You know, one other place where we had some very interesting breaks, and where I think religious groups are taking the lead, really, in a way, and on the same side, and where Americans are divided along party lines, but not along religious lines, is on this question we had about whether society would be better off if the distribution of wealth was more equal. 6 in 10 Americans say, yes, our society would be better off if the distribution of wealth was more equal. This goes right to the heart of what's, I think, at the center of the Occupy Wall Street movements. And here we have a majority of all major religious groups favoring it, majorities of Democrats and majorities of Independents saying, yes, our country would be better off, distribution of wealth was more equal. But Republicans on the other side, less than majority Republicans.
It is strange to me that we see closer percentages of consensus around the potential president's affiliation issue, people wanting a president that looks like them and goes to the same religious tradition they do. But we see more diversity around the values that most religions hold in common, even though we've said just in this interview that religion is a very important part of American politics. It is a politicized religion.
You know, it's right. When I said one of the things that surprised us is that we saw majorities of religious groups all on the same side of the issue, is that what we often see is religious groups tend to fall along party lines. So, for example, white evangelical Protestants who tend to vote about 8 in 10 Republican for presidential elections tend to fall on the Republican side of the ledger on most issues. And, you know, when we look at mainline Protestants that tend to lean the other way, they tend to fall the other side. But, you know, what's interesting to me and where I think we may be coming to a different place in the country is on this, you know, fundamental question of equality and addressing inequality in terms of policy at both the upper end and the lower end of the spectrum. You know, we seem to still have a consensus in the country that those are things that are really important for our policymakers to address.
Good point on which to conclude. There's a lot of valuable information and insight in this survey. It's well worth reading. The American Values Survey is available from Public Religion Research Institute at www.publicreligion.org. Dr. Robert P. Jones is CEO and founder of that institute. And Robbie, as always, thank you so much for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks. I'm always happy to be here.
Coming up next, investigative journalist and best-selling author Greg Pallas. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. This free State of Belief radio podcast is brought to you by Interfaith Alliance, representing 185,000 members across the U.S., drawn from 75 different faith traditions. We're committed to protecting faith and freedom. Find out about the work we do to protect the boundaries between religion and government and unite diverse voices to challenge extremism and build common ground by visiting our website, interfaithalliance.org. Whether you care deeply about minority religious rights, school bullying, LGBT discrimination, the influence of religion on politics, or the influence of politics on religion, Interfaith Alliance is working on initiatives you'll want to support. Learn more and become a member at interfaithalliance.org. Welcome back, everybody, to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. Shocking, surprising, jolting, enlightening, frightening, and informing. These are words that describe a new book I've been reading. I have read laughing, gasping, pondering, and admiring. The author of that book is sitting across the studio from me now, and we're going to be, thankfully, talking. Joining me in the studio is investigative journalist and best-selling author Greg Palast. BBC viewers in Great Britain would recognize him more readily than American viewers, even though he lives right here and works here. Former listeners of the Air America Radio Network will recognize his voice. Greg was a guest on many shows there. As his books, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy and Armed Madhouse, climbed the bestseller charts. Greg pretty much has one foot on an airplane already as he heads out for the book tour in support of his latest work, Vulture's Picnic, which goes on sale Monday. Greg, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Welton, it's a thrill to be here, actually.
I know you've been doing a lot of interviews about the investigations in this book, and the investigations themselves, as I've already hinted, are stunning. But I want to focus our conversation today on a part of the book that's not in the subtitle. And by the way, the subtitle is In Pursuit of Petroleum Pigs, Power Pirates, and High Finance Carnivores. You spend your time seeking out evil, surrounded by evil, often not being able to stop evil, but you also seem to manage to keep or even regain your sense of faith. Can you talk about that component of this story?
Yeah, well, I'm an investigative reporter, and investigative reporters doing their job tend not to uncover good, but evil. Here I was investigating what really happened with the Deepwater Horizon explosion, bribery, murder, mayhem, the drowning of the city of New Orleans, and getting the real stories underneath, old-fashioned investigative reporting. That's what I do. So I'm digging up the dirt, real dirt, serious stuff, and it's, you know, it's not nice. The vultures of Vulture's Picnic are these high-finance carnivores who have last week came back from the Congo, where you got financiers, billionaires from America stealing the money for clean water to prevent the cholera epidemic in Congo. I mean, when you talk about levels of evil, this is what I spend my life uncovering and exposing.
But how do you do that and not just say, I give up?
Well, at the beginning of the book, I do give up. I'm out in a stakeout in the snow in front of the Vulture's house, his financier. He's got a house bigger than the Vatican. And I just come back from Liberia, where I see the kids. He's taking Liberia's economy hostage. And hard to find kids there with four limbs because they had all these child soldiers. And maybe 20% of the kids were terribly wounded during the war. So here it seems to me that the Lord had destroyed all these innocent kids and rewarded the vulture with not only one home, but yachts and planes and the rest. Mm-hmm. And to me, that was the end of faith. That's where the book begins. In fact, I use, it was difficult with the publisher, but I use the F word, you know, F God, mm-hmm. and that's where it began. Mm-hmm. But then, it's funny, my lack of faith is challenged, and I'm angry with God. I hope he doesn't exist at the beginning of the book. And I don't believe in him, certainly, because this couldn't happen. But then I find out that God believes in me. So, I don't know why. You know, I'm a, boy, if people heard this, and I don't mind you playing that, because I always play the really tough guy investigative reporter with the fedora. I'm a real tough guy, tough hombre. And, but this is a different book in that while it's nonfiction, it becomes a story of a biblical story in which real people are invested with these, with the symbolic powers of great biblical characters. And I realize this as I'm going through this. And, you know, like, for example, I'm down in New Orleans and I meet Noah, in the form of Dr. Ivor von Heerden, otherwise known as Dr. Hurricane. Now, Dr. von Heerden of Louisiana Hurricane Center said on my network, BBC, 30 days before the Katrina flood and New Orleans was flooded, he said, within 1 month, the city could be underwater. And 30 days later, it was. He's a modern Noah. Here's a guy who, for being right, was fired. Oil company pressure ends up getting him fired from LSU for being right about the flood, because he warned and warned and warned. He warned the White House. He warned the governor. He warned the city. And no one listened to Noah's, Dr. Van Heerden's warning. And so then they went after him because he was right and fired him. But he stood up. And it's interesting. He even had an arc. He keeps, it was like I couldn't write this. You know, it's nonfiction. But, you know, he kept a boat that he was building in his backyard to leave. And he is. But what they didn't understand when they took on this guy, this Noah, that he had sailed to America from South Africa where he'd fought the apartheid regime. And so he's used to bullies and he wasn't going to let them bully him. So he stood up to them and he has fought and sued the university and the governor and the oil companies. And now he's won. He's getting they're agreeing, but he's now sailing back to South Africa. And so this is just one of the characters. But then, yeah, there are satanic figures in there. I mean, a real Satan. In fact, a nuclear industry spokeswoman who goes to this little township in Louisiana, one of the last places without running water or electricity, and says, we will offer you if to let this nuclear dump come here. And we'll give you, you know, basically we'll give you riches. And she holds up a handful of dirt and says, you have, and this is the nuclear, this is the radioactive stuff we're going to have here. But, and she shows these black people, these very poor people, this dirt and says, you have nothing to fear in this, from this dirt. Well, what's amazing is she probably did not realize is that she was using the lines for Aquinas, which is, you know, I'll show you fear in a handful of dirt. But the people are too smart and they reject the bargain with the devil. But first they call a professor at the university. She says, you know, the devil is a deceiver, right? Because they said, so this professor says, because she figures these black people are never going to bother calling someone. They call an expert. And he says, if that was uranium hexafluoride, which is what she was claiming it was, that's not safe, it would have vaporized and so would she. So it was deception and they reject it and they find it. So you have all these incredible biblical stories within a nonfiction book about an investigation of oil company, financial, and nuclear industry perfidy is really stories about – more stories about people who stand up to it rather than just the evil.
Greg, we've got to take a quick break. We'll be right back. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio. Welcome back, everyone, to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. I'm talking to best-selling investigative journalist Greg Pallas. You know, Greg, I want you to, if you will, turn in the book to one of your passages because I want you to read that for our listeners. But as you do, if you want to read a hard-hitting, great journalistic book on what happened out in the Gulf of Mexico, and what happened in New Orleans, read this book. It is political. It is sociological. It is factual. I had to keep reminding myself that this is true. This is not fiction. This is
frighteningly
not
true. Yeah.
So if you don't want to read about religion, that doesn't mean don't read this book. Read the book, and you're going to see some religious underpinnings to it, and actually, between every line, a struggle that you talked about.
And by the way, I want to emphasize that this is almost a secret radio show because no one's supposed to know that there's religious content in this book. There isn't one word in here which says this is a book about faith and religion.
Absolutely.
And yeah. So there's 400 pages of investigative reporting. It's a story of evil that goes from the Arctic. Literally, I go up to the Arctic Circle, into the Amazon rainforest, into Central Asia, dictatorships, into the Congo. It's on a hunt for evil, but there's nothing that indicates it's only. So this is our kind of secret, and
that's
those
right.
Reading this will pick up these issues. So this is like a special secret program, and we're not going to tell anyone. This is just special for you because I'm doing all these other shows where it's all about, you know, British Petroleum, right, and the evils and Goldman Sachs. But actually, these are just – I don't even think that these big corporations understand. They're actually players in a millennial struggle, and that's what this book is about.
Read us Satan.
So I'll start at the top. Chapter 1, Goldfinger. Rolling hills outside New York City. It's all my fault because I'm such a cheap b****. I was told to rent a white van, something nondescript that painters or handyman might use and wouldn't be noticed parked down a road where only BMWs and Carrera 95s play. But I was afraid BBC wouldn't pay for the van rental. I was right about that. And so here I was in the Red Menace, my 14-year-old busted-up Honda with the brakes idiot light on. Anyway, I won't move. I can wait you out. Well, maybe I can. I'm freezing insane cold, and the Dunkin' Donuts coffee is cold, and I have to urinate. And out the last three cups I killed waiting on the Vulture to drive through his estate's electronic gate to his work so I can somehow tail him unseen in my ridiculous red car. And now God is snowing on me. Thick, nasty, wet, heavy pre-dawn snow, so everything turns white, except my red beater. Might as well stick a flashing sign on the hood. I am on a stakeout. I am looking for you. We started at 4 a.m. It looks really glamorous on screen when we broadcast these stories. The dramatic, long-lens footage, then the jump and the confrontation. But after four horridly cold hours, there is nothing glamorous, just my bladder screaming at me. Bad penny calls from our Toyota, staked out in front of Vulture's office building. Same issue. She and Jackie have to pee. Now they could blow the whole story because, God forbid, they should just squat behind a tree and make some yellow snow. The women insist on porcelain and have to leave their post. All right, damn it. Find a gas station, but don't let them see you. Ricardo is cuddling his camera. His baby, Ricardo, is calm. Ricardo was always calm. He's just back from Iraq, where calm kept him alive. Ricardo is never hungry. Ricardo is never cold and never needs to urinate. Whatever drug he's on, I want it. I tell Ricardo, we stay. Why? If God doesn't give a rat's ass about the vulture and what he does for a living, what he's done to Africa, why should I? Well, God. If I were a psychologist, I'd say I'm here because my father worked in a furniture store in the barrio in Los Angeles, selling pure crap on layaway to Mexicans. Then later on, he sold fancier crap to fancier people in Beverly Hills, and he hated furniture. And I hated the undeserving pricks and their trophy wives who bought it. I could smell their cash and smell the corpses they stole it from. They were all vultures, and the rest of us were just food. So there you have it, my story. My motivation, resentment, envy, revolutionary fervor, whatever. But I'm not a psychologist. I'm a reporter.
What happened in the course of writing this book and the journey that caused it to take a hard-nosed reporter from F God to the hope and strength to carry out the mission you were doing?
Well, I ran into a lot of courageous people. And I was arrested in the desert. Another biblical reference. I was wandering in the desert, got arrested by the secret police in the dictatorship of Azerbaijan. And I'm with a guy who says he's going to tell the truth about the dictatorship, but when the police show up and they throw him in a dungeon, rip out his fingernails, no question. So he gets scared. And they say, okay, why don't you do an interview with this reporter, me? And they're going to watch. They want to see what he's going to say now. They're going to let him do the interview. So suddenly he switches. And in his language, I ask about corruption in the dictatorship. And he says, anyone who says that the government here is corrupt is doing the work of Israel. It's an Islamic republic, right? The work of Israel. In other words, well, in the Bible, Israel is the name given to Jacob after he wrestles with the angel. And suddenly, I think about the work of Israel. And at first, you know, I'm dismissing, okay, he's becoming, you know, he's playing to the Islamic dictatorship. But there was I don't think he understood that biblical reference. And I'm not sure it didn't strike me at first either. I thought it was just ridiculous. But at least I wasn't going to prison. But later I go then and meet someone else, a woman named Mervari. She is trying to form a labor union of British Petroleum workers, which is in this dictatorship. And there are pictures of her being beaten by the police. She's in her 60s. She's beaten and jailed. And suddenly, the work of Israel crosses my mind. Israel. Jacob had said to the Lord, will you stay my brother's hand, Esau? Because he's afraid that when he crosses the river, and crosses Edom into Edom, he'll be beaten up. And the Lord basically says, man, he wrestles with the angel, with the Lord. He wrestles with his own lack of courage. And he never gets the promise that he'll be protected by the Lord. Instead, the Lord says, from now on, you're Israel. And which means you have wrestled with God. And he could then cross into Edom unafraid. And this was what this woman did. So she was doing the work of Israel, not some nation state, but the work of the Lord.
And therein comes hope. What do you want readers of this book to take away from it?
What I found out from Dr. Von Heerden Noah and from this woman, Mervari, doing the work of Israel. It is not corporate evil, which is the problem. It's our own lack of courage.
Vulture's Picnic, In Pursuit of Petroleum Pigs, Power Parrots, and High Finance Carnivores. Investigative journalist Greg Palast is the best-selling author of Armed Madhouse and The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. His new book, Vulture's Picnic, comes out on Monday. It's a deeply personal story as well as a globe-trotting true crime adventure. Greg, I want to thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio, and I want to tell you that I want us to find a time to do a much longer interview.
I promise we will.
Take care of yourself.
Thanks.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Visit us online at stateofbelief.com to find out more about the show and sign up for our podcast. Contact information is available at stateofbelief.com, including the listener line, 202-238-3291. We encourage you to tell others about the show and to continue the conversation that starts here on State of Belief Radio, both in your daily life and online. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics, where there's always, always controversy and usually some surprise. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.